WMST, Dallas to Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively bringing the Crab Cake Tour back out on the road. We'll be talking about the Maryland Lottery, our dear friends at Goodwill, as well as Window Nation. 2-for-1. I'll be telling you about that all month. Listen, we've done Roe versus Wade. We've done Ravens off season and schedule, and we've done Orioles and Adley Rutschman and Preakness and all that stuff. I got to get back to some rock and roll because I've been doing things over the last couple of months that have taken me places. And anybody follows me on social media, you know I was in Long Island last weekend with John Mayer, hanging out with Barry Trotz. We're now referring to that Cuban meal as the Last Supper. That was Saturday in Long Island. I'm the coach killer. Apparently, when Trotz comes home, we'll have to figure all that out. But I've been traveling around to shows. I went out to Chicago to see some friends, saw John Mayer, hung out with Lifer friends. Went to Madison Square Garden to see John Mayer, hung out with friends. Little John Mayer thing, that's cool. But he was the one on the road. Pearl Jam's up next. There's all sorts of concerts all summer long. We've lost a drummer to the Foo Fighters. And all of this rock and roll has made me nostalgic, or in my case, nostalgic. And I started getting these crazy belt buckles. I had a Led Zeppelin belt buckle back in 1979. I've told this story with Mickey Coachella and John Allen and some of my rocker friends. And I acquired the Van Halen belt buckle, which is a little bit like the Holy Grail. I'd say Cheap Trick might be the Holy Grail at this point. You know, I'm working on that Police belt buckle. Very difficult to get. But I got this one and I thought, you know what? I got to have that crazy professor guy, that Van Halen historian guy on. And then like the other day, it was Alex Van Halen's birthday. And Alex was always very magnanimous toward me when I was a young kid, giving me alcohol before I was, don't put him in jail. I was 18. It was Philadelphia. Have different rules there. Greg Renoff joins us now. He is that author. He is the guy who wrote Van Halen Rising, How a Southern California Backyard Party Band Saved Heavy Metal. Greg, it is a pleasure to have you on from Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's a pleasure to see you. The last time we did the show, Eddie was alive. I was just a radio show. You didn't get to see my nasty bitch shirt, and I didn't get to see how nice your hat is. How are things in Tulsa? How's the book-selling Van Halen business?
Hey, things are good. A lot of exciting things happening here in Tulsa. Bob Dylan Museum opened on Monday, the Bob Dylan Center, which has been years in the making, so that's incredibly cool for Tulsa. It's going to be right nearby the Woody Guthrie Center. And that was one of the main reasons, from what I understand, why Dylan wanted his center to be there, because he's such obviously an inheritor of the Guthrie tradition. And so good stuff.
Tulsa's a music town now. I saw Rush open a tour there a couple years ago. Give everybody your background. I mean, if anybody heard the first one, they'll probably be here for this one. You and I sort of lingered longer into the Van Halen vault and memories and how the band got put together. And your book's so unique because it's really kind of a prequel book, right?
Yeah, so I had the idea of sort of trying to go back to the prehistoric Van Halen days to see how the band formed in Pasadena and how they got together with David Lee Roth and how the brothers sort of made common cause with him and figured out how to start playing around in Pasadena backyard parties and then eventually biker bars and nightclubs and eventually to the Sunset Strip and then their record deal and beyond. So the idea was basically to do something like, if people remember the Social Network movie, sort of like where you have the backstory, where you have the launch at the end, where you sort of get them out into the world, which I thought was the more I, as a historian, dug around, I realized there really hadn't been any sort of narrative built about that. And I thought that was actually, when I did more research onto it, the really exciting part of their story that hadn't really been told.
It's amazing, dude. I'm 53. I've been through a plague. I've been to 28 Super Bowls. I've lived my lifelong dream, right? Like the fact that we ever got a football team here ever to begin with. I've written books on championships with teams here. I've got a Super Bowl head coach as a partner. Sports has been my life. My last name's Aparicio. The reason I'm in this country, the reason we immigrated to this country was because of baseball and my cousin playing for the Orioles and the White Sox back in the 50s and 60s. So like I have all this sports background, right? And I've loved sports all my life. But I have found since the beginning of the plague and really since my wife's illness, my wife had leukemia in 2014 and 15. She survived. She's had two bone marrow transplants. And at the end of her survival, I wound up going and seeing Bruce Springsteen a bunch on the River Tour when he went out and did the River every single night. And I probably saw a dozen of those shows over about 3 months. And it was at that point that I really sort of launched off of sports has become more like work, and going to concerts has become like the only thing that gives me, other than traveling, maybe eating a good meal, right? Seeing someone you love, which is my favorite thing, because I put that in with concerts now. Like, you know, so when I make these trips, I see old bosses, old friends, you know, and get together around. If I come to Tulsa, you and I are having beer. We just are. I hope there's not like a tornado coming through that, like there was the last time I was there. they handed me the keys to the rental car in Tulsa, and they're like, make sure you park this in a garage. Don't leave this on the street. And I'm like, why? They're like, well, if a tornado picks it up, you're going to have to pay for it. I'm like, what?
I have a friend in California who said, like, I'd rather have an earthquake. Yeah, I have a friend in California who said, I'd rather have deal with earthquakes. They said, well, we have those here. They're not quite as bad as on the West Coast, but we have those here too. So we have tornadoes and earthquakes.
Well, I mean, just for music and what it means all these years later, that a guy your age, my age, we're probably similar age. I'm 53. Mm-hmm. You're in a whole different world. You're a professor. You tell me what you do and how you wound up here, because it is amazing, music being this glue that once it's over, and other than going to seeing Sammy and Michael Anthony, and you can, and they were in Atlantic City a couple, it's getting toured over. And I missed Sting last night. And, you know, I'm catching the Eagles three times, because it's just getting toward the end for a lot of bands. Yeah. And I guess that Springsteen story comes, the reason I'm even thinking about it, putting it together, during that Springsteen tour, my wife almost died. She lived. She was good. David Bowie died. Glenn Frey died. And Prince died, all in 140 show run of Bruce Springsteen's tour. He was doing tributes to Glenn Frey, to David Bowie, and to, in the end, Prince, who was very young. And I start to think, you know what? And then Tom Petty died on us. I got to go to some shows. And that's become my mojo. So, like, talking to guys like you that chronicle this, this is the stuff I want to read about if I love Van Halen.
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, it's like, you live it growing up and it seems like it's never going to end. I mean, that's the thing that's really interesting about all these bands, is that there's sort of this sense when you're 18, 19, that this is forever. And then, you know, people start to pass away, bands break up, and then, or if the bands come back around, they're not the same that they were before. Obviously things change and different members, and it becomes a different animal in some cases altogether. And so, yeah, that was one of the motivators for me to write the book too, because it's, you know, I wanted to preserve that. And I realized a lot of the folks I was talking to, so I'm about your age, I'm 52, and you know, a lot of the folks I was talking to who grew up in Pasadena with the brothers, or grew up in high school with Roth and Michael Anthony, they're about 10 years older than or more than I am. And I started to realize, you know, that, you know, those folks aren't going to live together forever either. And, you know, they're not in the grave yet. But, you know, if you don't try to document this material as a historian, it gets lost to time. And I really wanted to get that put together, just be as a fan and as somebody who thought this band, Van Halen, made a particularly big contribution to the history of rock. And I really thought they hadn't really gotten their due in the way that some of the other bands that the Eagles and Van Halen, Eagles and Zeppelin and The Who, there've been the Beatles, tons and tons and tons of books. And, you know, I'm not saying that Van Halen is the same as the Beatles, but I didn't feel that there had been enough research done on a band that was very significant in their own way. And obviously it's a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and sold hundreds of millions of records and all the rest. So I just really wanted to do that work.
Well, I mean, the death of Neil Peart also is just kind of shook me, probably more than any other rock and roll death, quite frankly. And I saw Petty three times on that last tour before he died. I saw him about 4 weeks before he died. I felt like I dragged myself to Philadelphia on a 100-degree night. I'd seen him twice at Red Rocks, and I was like, need to see him one more time. Got a great seat. Love that tour. Love the show. And then it's just like, you blink and it's over, and Clarence Clemens is gone, or Danny Federici's gone, or Styx is out playing with different members, or Cheap Trick has a different drummer, or band members have COVID. I mean, Journey canceled a show this week because band members get COVID. So, like, all of these things that can go wrong to F it up, that didn't happen on the Diver Down tour, even with all the Jack Daniels. They still made it to the stage, dude.
Yeah, there's a famous story. Eddie Van Halen talks about having the flu, you know, and of course, you know, this is the age of catching viruses and getting sick, and that there was a garbage can behind the amps, and he would just play, puke, like go out of the shadows and puke and come back and play some more. He was so sick, you know, it was like the show must go on. And like, even if you have like a stomach virus and you're like, should be in bed with a fever, you play.
Well, a lot of money, a lot of things to say. Greg Renoff's here. The book is Van Halen Rising. So with your background, you're an East Coast guy. You're not Tulsa and all that. You're a professor of what? And give us your journey to doing this book.
So I grew up in New Jersey, and I'm a historian. And along my academic journey, I attended the University of Maryland. So I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with
Maryland,
that great institution.
We're all behind. on you. Yeah, we got a new coach.
I did not graduate from the University of Maryland, but I attended there. I was there for a couple of years in the late 80s and had a wonderful time. I'll just say that's the
7 years
time
of college down the drain, right?
pretty much. And so, I ended up going off to grad school and I did my PhD at Brandeis. And then I actually taught college for quite a long time and now I'm writing full time. But that was my journey, my rock and roll journey. And of course, growing up in the New Jersey in the 80s, saw Monsters of Rock and just so many shows at the Meadowlands with Brendan Byrd Arena, as it was called, Madison Square Garden, NASA Coliseum. These were the venues that I would go to all the time. And so you have deep East Coast roots, and that's where I saw that's where I saw all the good shows.
I see the old farce with the shirt that says, I may be old, but I saw the good shows. So like you started mentioning Jersey, I was at the Amnesty show when the Police played their last show and Bono walked on water and Peter Gabriel was doing Sledgehammer, like crazy stuff. I was at Brendan Byrne the night that they shot With or Without You. You two shot With or Without You there. So like I on the Joshua Tree tour, early in that tour when Bono had lost his voice and like all that. And I just, the history of all this, dude, it's crazy. This belt buckle, it says right on the back, 1978. This is 44 years old. Like the fact that we're losing people and bands have broken up in the history, but Van Halen, of all the bands that, of that era and their largeness, really Shakespearean, right? From like sort of a writing, sort of now we have true tragedy in Eddie losing his life and his son is now doing this thing. And like, and Sammy's off a billionaire selling tequila and hanging out with Mike and they're playing their music and all, but the book's not fully written. You chose to write the really early part of it. Who's documented the middle of all of this other than Hagar going on Howard Stern or Hagar doing a show? Like, to me, the 5150 era and the OU812 era, for me, all these years later, it's the music I prefer. Now, that's not to say that I don't listen to Dance the Night Away or Beautiful Girls, or I crank up Van Halen 1, and if I could get me a Van Halen 1, if I could get this logo on a t-shirt at Ocean City this summer, I'd buy it, But that being said, they are one of those bands that there aren't enough books written about that I know of. I know about you doing this, but I would also say I want to read more about them and more about how effed up it must have been to be doing Just a Gigolo when you came out of 1984 and you're sort of Mr. Roboto era for, other bands to say this was Fonzie jumping the shark, right?
Yeah. The second book I did, following the Van Halen book, I did the authorized autobiography of Ted Templeman, who produced the first six Van Halen records and worked on the Foreign Lawful Carnal Knowledge record. And you mentioned, to bring it up, you mentioned the Roth EP, the Just Gigolo. So he did that and he did Eat 'Em and Smile. And so, that's one book, obviously, that tells a lot.
I'll have Van a glazed donut.
Pretty much.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. So Ted has a very interesting perspective on all that. He did Doobie Brothers and Little Feet and so many other bands along the way. But the other book I really like is Ian Christie's The Van Halen Saga, which is out a few years ago, but that's a really, really good one. An author named Michael Christopher did a book recently as well. I mean, there's a number of them that are coming out as well. Since Eddie passed, there's been a number of books that are coming out. And so, the more the merrier in a lot of ways, because, for me, it's such a significant act, even putting aside the band itself, just Eddie Van Halen's guitar influence, as we all know. And that was one of the things that I think, especially in the last year or so since Eddie passed away, there's been a bigger and bigger appreciation of the musical contributions of this guy just to, just as a songwriter and as a technician on the guitar and his work on keyboards as well. I think there was really is a more of a three-dimensional picture of Eddie kind of coming forward, not just the guy who plays guitar in Van Halen, but really what he did, which, happens a lot of times after people we really, really admire pass away, is that people start to dig deeper into their career. But there's a long way to go. I mean, I think I read there's like as many books written about the Beatles as there've been around the American Civil War, something like that. It's like hundreds of Beatles books have been written. Yeah. I mean, hundreds. So, there's a ways to go, but I really am glad, because to me, that's, how you document, whether it be a documentary, which maybe one day there'll be a Van Halen documentary, but in the meantime, these books can really help people, get the full scope of what an artist accomplished and what they really gave to the world.
Why has there not been a behind the musical? I mean, It's so thick, right? Like Roth himself is his own thing. Hagar. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I just saw that, piece with the Beats, Dr. Dre thing, just unbelievable business behind Hagar, the business who, you know, and I knew Ed Leffler, you know, a little bit 30 years ago, who managed them, and these people that, I was confusing him with the shortstop. These people that were part of this, all of the video, I've seen that grainy footage from Pasadena back in the day. I found an incredible Japanese piece, OU812 era, maybe right before FUCK era in Tokyo, that they're just blistering and sober. Sammy's in the band and they're very sober. Yeah. It was well shot. It's just otherworldly to how great they were, especially when Sammy came in the band. But to your point, you'd say they were blazing and Van Halen too, when they're ripping up arenas and playing Roth swinging the mic and doing all the karate stuff. And like, but getting all of that together and seeing what Petty did with his stuff, the Eagles have done with their stuff, putting it all together in a 3 or 4 hour, I mean, history still will never end. Right. But Van Halen feels like, it's very old school campfire tales and a couple of books that are involved in that way.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, that circles back to, you know, exactly why I wanted to write the book. But putting that aside, getting to the point about a documentary, I mean, I obviously, that would be up to Alex to speak on at this point. He's the main member of Van Halen. Obviously, I think the person who probably has the controlling interest in what happens with the future of the band. I suspect that, you know, when Alex said 20 years ago that he liked having a bit of a mystique about a band, like he thought like Zeppelin, you know, they put out The Song Remains the Same, but it wasn't as if it was like, they sat down and they went through all the stories of like, you know, I got mad at this guy or we did this together. It was like, there was kind of a mystery about the band. And I suspect that's partly still what drives him to do what he does, which is they have not done that type of documentary. They never did it behind the music. You're right. Which is very unusual, right? Very, very unusual.
And you know, they haven't worn out merch either, right? I mean, for me to not have a Van Halen shirt, be able to buy it at Walmart when I could buy AC/DC or Guns N' Roses or and Aerosmith, you know, I mean, there are a lot of bands that have done that. I don't know, like, if there's pride or if it's just privacy or if it's, to your point, mystique, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing probably that I suspect is probably plays a role in that too is that you have these, you know, like with a band like, you know, with the Who or the Stones, you have the two main guys who have sort of been locked in all the way along. It was Zeppelin too, with Page and Plant. And I suspect that part of that is that there's the dynamics with the different camps, whether it's, you know, it's Hagar and there's Gary Cherone and there's David Lee Roth. And so I suspect that's part of why we've never had that sort of all encompassing documentary, is that you have this, you know, that might be even a barrier, even if, let's just say Alex says tomorrow, I want to do a documentary. There might be a bit of a barrier. They're trying to navigate all those different camps. I don't know that for sure, but it's, you know, obviously it could happen. I mean, look, let's look, you know, Irving Azoff manages Van Halen and he manages the Eagles. He got the Eagles to sit for a documentary, like, or presumably he had something to do with that. And I think that, like, in terms of the betting lines in Vegas, I assume that was like, you know, never going to happen, right? That's like the longest shot of longest shots. And they did that. And so I personally would love to see that. I mean, I think that's what everybody who's a Van Halen fan kind of wants, is that sort of that Beatles type of documentary, the Eagles type of documentary, that really just gives you insight. It doesn't have to be sort of the traditional type of documentary, but something that gives you that sort of insight into the band, a visual and some new stories directly from the participants. Like, Alex has never written a book. Alex has not given very many interviews. As we know, Eddie never wrote a book. You know, it would be great to have those stories direct from the source. I mean, especially from Alex, who was there at ground zero with his brother, you know, the day those guys started playing music together. There's nobody who can tell that story of the Eddie and Alex journey to Van Halen other than Alex. There's nobody, you know.
Did you see the Bee Gees doc?
I have seen it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just all of these, I guess it speaks to when you can't see the Bee Gees anymore, you can't see Van Halen anymore, you can't see Tom Petty anymore. This is the investment, is I get a belt buckle. I don't want any more CDs or downloads. Right. or right. maybe finding old concert footage from right. a night that you were there or near being there.
Right.
I wasn't at the New Haven show in New Haven, but right. I was at the Philadelphia and the DC show 3 weeks later. And remember the bras hitting the stage and the Dave Sucks banners and like all that stuff. Greg Randolph is here. Van Halen Rising is his book, How a Southern California Backyard Party Band Saved Heavy Metal. Also a book on Ted Templeman. You can go check out all of that. Just Google him. He's easy to find. He's also usually sharing fun pictures of Van Halen eating French fries outside of McDonald's and in weird gear back on some tour bus in 1977 or whatever.
Ketchup over the, all over their heads or something in Tokyo. Like they, yeah.
Well, you know, striped red guitars or fun things like that. There is something about being in your seat. And I'm a huge Rush fan, right? But there's that dude in Buffalo that collects everything. At some point, I'll try to get him on. And I've had Getty on many times. I've talked to Alex. I've had Sammy on the show. Like, I've done a lot of these sort of weird little anecdotal things. But I'm wondering what's left when you're 53 and the guitar player's dead and they're not coming back to town anymore. And you passed on the 1984 tour and wonder why. Or you think about that other time you could have, should have, might have gone to see that show. You try to interact with this. And when I was a young guy, I had the old guys who were Beatles fans and Birds fans and Dylan fans say to me,
yep.
The music you listen to when you're 18, you'll be listening to your whole life.
Your whole life.
So far. Yeah, so far.
So far. So yeah, it's true. Yeah, it's really true. Like, yeah, right. They're like the whatever you drank your first beer to, that's going to be your music for the rest of your life. I mean, there is a great deal of truth to that. There really is a great deal of truth to that. And yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there is, and that's the other thing too. I mean, whatever band we're talking about from this era, I mean, Sabbath is another great example, is that Sabbath has done a really good job, I think, of giving deluxe editions, you know, the Steven Wilson remixes of the different Sabbath albums with, you know, you have the original version, then you have the remix version, and people eat that stuff up. They love it. Again, you're not selling a million copies of that, but there is a very, very voracious marketplace of Black Sabbath fans who want that stuff. And I enjoy listening to that stuff. You know, I'm a Sabbath fan, and it's just cool to sort of have that ability to reconnect or reimagine an album that you've heard 300 times in the last 10 years, you know, not in your whole life. And so it's really, I think, an opportunity for a lot of these bands, because there still is, obviously, you have fans like us who are 50s and 60s and so on, where, you know, they're sort of in your prime earning, you know, in your prime theory, your prime income, and you're willing to pay for these things. And so, because like you said, you can't go back. I mean, you cannot go back. And if you miss that show and you've heard Led Zeppelin 10,000 times, you're super psyched when Robert and Jimmy decide to put out these reissues with all these new tracks, and he's leaving little fragments, like, you know, 1 minute of Whole Lot of Love we've never heard before. People are like, that's amazing, you know, just to hear that a couple of times is amazing, you know, to kind of have that chance to revisit.
Well, I'm trying to find new things. Robert Plant's playing the old tennis stadium up in Flushing in June, and I'm going to go just to see Robert Plant play in an old place in Flushing. And I feel like there's these last experiences that every time I see a band, because I'm getting to be at that point, thinking like, here we are.
Right.
Pearl Jam's in their prime. Right. I mean, U2, when they come out, they're still as vibrant and as incredible. I mean, Mayer running around with the Dead and bringing that music back for young people. Mm-hmm. There's nothing like live music. Listen, I like a big screen. I like being trapped in a room. I like when Rush sells me a ticket for $16 and makes me cry, and I go to the theater and they crank it up and do all that stuff. But I'm not going to see Rush anymore. And there's a part of that that's really like, that bothers me. I don't know what else to say. Cover bands are doing well too. I mean, that's another thing. Going out and experiencing Get the Lead Out or these bands that go and do this at a high, high level, there's going to be a real marketplace for that over the next 15 years.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the other thing. That's the real indicator. I mean, I don't know how many bands there's, you know, I'm a big advocate of, there's bands, there's Van Halen, there's Nerd Halen. There's a number of these tribute bands of all different varieties and stripes, but there are probably dozens of Van Halen tribute bands alone and like Zeppelin bands. And so there is this obviously this market too. I mean, that's the thing, is that these songs are going to live on, you know, that will be stuff that even after the bands are long, long, long gone and put to bed, there is going to be people who still want to hear that music. And I think there's you know, just been that article that's come out a few weeks ago that talked about basically that old music, basically the music from the 60s and the 70s, is really what drives most of the plays on Spotify. It's that the people are not really quote unquote discovering new bands, rock bands. It's sort of the old classic tunes that people sort of, even young people, you know, like my nephew, who's a big fan of ZZ Top and and a fan of the Eagles. He's, you know, he's going back and listening to Desperado, and he's going back to listen to Eliminator and stuff like that. That's what he wants to listen to, and not necessarily seeking out new bands. So that's, you know, that's a real a reality, is that this music is really embedded in the culture in a way that, in part because of the major labels, were able to push that stuff out and get it so pushed, you know, into all the different corners of our life that, you know, that's what people still gravitate towards, even young people.
Well, the layover of sports and music for me in my life, that when a player was there, there was a band there and all of that kind of thing, that the way it weaves together, and sports is always trying to tell the story of what happened with the Steelers in 1976 or what happened with the Colts, or, you know, and we're sort of the same way that young people, I remember when Eliminator came out and like the video, like we have an experience with it that's different than the first time you hear Give Me All Your Love and Her Legs or Sharp Dressed Man, which we actually discussed on the show last week because there's a charity called Sharp Dressed Man here. Greg Renoff's here. We're talking old rock and roll because we can't go see the old bands, or we can. What's moving you these days in Tulsa? I came so close to seeing Hagar and Anthony up in Atlantic City. It was a night where, like, driving 120 miles, and it was winter, and it was in a theater. It was pricey. It was like, we just didn't do it. I regret it. Yeah. I fully regret it. He played Wolf Trap last summer as well. I regret it. I want to go out. But a lot of this is based on how far, how much, how's the weather,
right,
what night of the week is it, what else have, right, I got going on? But there's nothing I'd rather do than go see Sammy Hagar shake his ass and sing, because he's 75, and how much longer is he going to do it?
That's a lightning bolt to the soul. Sing to 75. How's that even possible? Yeah, I mean, Tulsa is really experiencing a cultural renaissance here. I really would urge people around the country to come check it out if they have the means and the time. Give you a couple examples. I mentioned the Bob Dylan Center. The Woody Guthrie Center has been here for a few years. It's fantastic. It has a rotating exhibit from either the Grammy Museum or the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. For example, the LA punk band X had a display here a couple of years ago, and it was fabulous. I mean, all these old concert photos and stage clothes and stuff like that. And so you kind of go in there and you can get the taste of the old Woody Guthrie 1940s and 1950s troubadour stuff, the singer songwriter stuff, and then go into another room and see that Henry Diltz exhibit as well. There's also, Kane's Ballroom is alive and well. They had a really hard time during the pandemic, obviously being shut down, but that place has been going for close to 100 years now, and it's incredible. I mean, I've seen Blackberry Smoke there. I've seen tons and tons of bands. Elvis Costello was just here and played, and from what I understand, Elvis talks about Kane's as like one of his absolute favorite places to play in the entire world. I think he
didn't
played here first.
Petty get dragged there? Didn't Petty get dragged to Tulsa to do an album early in his career?
Well, really, I'm glad you brought that up. So there is a studio / performance space that has just been reopened called the Church Studios. In the 1970s, Leon Russell, who's from Oklahoma, from Tulsa, had a label called Shelter Records, and he had a headquarters here in Tulsa, and he bought an old church and made a recording studio out of it. It eventually fell into disrepair, and it was recently purchased and revived by
a
lady here named... Yeah, it holds about, well, it's not that big. It holds about 100 people. For example, Ann Wilson is coming, and so it's one of, you know, there is this ability to have it as a performance space, but also you can cut a record there. So it's a historic landmark now, and it's got just an incredibly cool old vibe to it. But that's where Mudcrutch recorded a couple of songs on Shelter Records. So Shelter Records was going in the 70s. Eventually, they moved to L.A., but so you have this as well now as another place for people to come check out. They can tour it. And as I said, there's been live performances. They're very intimate, 100 tickets, super intimate for people who want to, you know, go see an artist in that type of close setting. And so, yeah, a lot of BOK Center, which is the new arena, was built in the last 10 or 15 years. I just saw Megadeth there. It was a fabulous show. It's a really, really basically top of the line venue. A lot of the shows, if they don't play Dallas, they'll play Tulsa. So there's a lot of great things happening with music here in Tulsa. People should come check it out.
Well, I would say the Tulsa Arena is the nicest arena I've ever been in. I was blown away. It felt like oil money was involved when I went there. I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, there's definitely some oil money here. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, no doubt about that. Greg Renoff is a good friend of the show. He's a rock and roll historian as well as a regular historian. What are you a regular historian of?
Well, I was trained. my professors who trained me probably look and say, what happened to this guy? But I was trained to be a 19th and 20th century U.S. cultural history, basically, you know, pop culture and stuff like that. And so I just sort of gravitated more towards rock and roll, the sort of the more conventional sorts of pop culture that I could have done. But it's just, you know, for me, if the whole having a doctorate just allowed me to be able to research things and put things together the right way. I was trained, you know, trained to do that. And so, you know, and I like to say to everybody out there, you know, I just stayed in school longer than you. I just didn't quit. I started at whatever, University of Maryland. I just kept going, just getting more credits. And eventually, you know, they give you the PhD and send you on your way.
Well, look, man, your hair's long. I got to let mine down. We got rock and roll hair. Rock and roll hair. You know, we got to do it. COVID happened, right? And COVID, I haven't had long hair since 94. Baseball player named Brad Pennington cut my Eddie Vedder. I had a total mullet. You know, I had the Barry Melrose, Wayne Gretzky 1992 thing going on. And I had it cut at Hooters in 1994, and I hadn't grown my hair. And then my hair started to grow during COVID, and I figured I'm letting it out. I just did a Hammer Jacks documentary a couple of weeks ago, and I had long hair. I felt so authentic. You know what I mean?
There you go. That's the real deal. Kicks and Hammer Jacks. Talk about missed opportunities. I never went to Hammer Jacks. I never went to Hammer Jacks when I was there. I just didn't. And big regret, you know, I had planned for a longer stay at University of Maryland and it just didn't happen. So, nonetheless, that is an absolute legendary venue and one of the great, great lost rock venues. Definitely.
Oh yeah, man. So they took us down to Merriweather I won't bore you with this, but I was the backstage underage 17-year-old, almost famous rock critic at Hammer Jacks throughout the whole four of the 6 years I covered it. I was under 21. I turned 21. Oh. Then I kicked the job out, went and did radio, but
Whatever innocence you had was immediately vaporized after 20 minutes backstage at Hammer Jacks. I'm sure
anyone that would ask, just cause I know, you know, this era and you probably want to know if you wanted to see the best groupies, it wasn't Poison. It was LA Guns. LA Guns had the best groupies, and if I ever see Tracy Guns, I'll let him know that. So there were more groupies. Just if we're talking about volume. LA Guns was always – I didn't even like the band. I just went down there just to see the show. You know what I mean? Because it was insane.
Right. Tracy's a good dude. He's narrated a new documentary on Randy Rhoads, which is coming out very soon if it's not already out. So I'm very, very excited to see that. Tracy really, you know, flies the – flag for all those great bands and is a great, great follow on Twitter. People should follow him.
Ambassador. Absolutely. I follow Tracy Guns. Everybody does. All right, Greg, I'm going to follow you and hopefully we won't be 5 years and nobody in the band will have to die to get us together. Okay. I didn't want it to be all morose because I did a whole bunch of Neil Peart stuff with buddies of mine and it was kind of somber. I could take this Eddie thing and get us really sad, but I'm trying not to. And to leave this on a good note, his kid's band and his kid seems to be a really good guy. And I know sort of came into the band sideways at the end and of that, but his son is doing right by his legacy, I believe.
I've seen them 3 or 4 times now. The last time I saw them, I will tell you, I saw them in New Jersey at a Starland Ballroom. And actually one of the guys in the band had taken ill. And so they came out as a trio. And so Wolfgang kind of came out and was like, okay, here's the deal. We've never played as a three-man band before, but we don't want to cancel the show. We're going to do this. And he was incredible. There was all these layered guitar parts in the Mammoth WVH music, which is really, really cool, but he did it all one guitar. So basically, you know what, when it's time for a solo, it was just bass going like Rush, like bass going guitar solo and drums. It was amazing. And it was a huge eye opener for me. Like what just, you know, this guy can do it. I mean, this guy can really do it. There's nothing stopping this guy from just continuing to grow as a musician, as a songwriter. And I'll tell you the other thing too, that people, if you have not seen Mammoth live before, what blew me away most of all, because you know, the Eddie Van Halen, Alex Van Halen musical DNA, you kind of figure even if Eddie didn't give his son guitar lessons, as Wolfie says, there was an inheritance of that. There's something to that, but his voice blew my mind in that room. I was just, you know, the first time I heard him is so strong, very distinctive. And he is a really, really, really great rock singer. And that actually is, to me, the most remarkable thing about him, beyond sort of he can play keyboards, he can play bass, he can play drums, he can play guitar. Yeah, I get that, right? But the voice is like, wow. So definitely check that band out. I love the album.
There you go. All right. Well, good. Plug for the young man. I like that.
Hey, Greg, deserves I appreciate it. He deserves it.
Well, you know what? I hope we get together in Tulsa at some point or hereabouts or at some rock and roll thing. Jimmy Ursay is trying to drag me to New York to see all the old Jim Ursay collection of all stuff in New York. So I'm probably going to do that. I'm just a sucker for rock and roll, dude. So anytime I get a chance to talk some rock and roll, mixing up with sports and politics and Roe versus Wade and all that crazy stuff we do around here, I appreciate you, man. Greg Randolph, go follow him. Van Halen Rising is the book, and a true historian of all things rock and roll. And I should tell you this, you know, my wife wasn't into Sabbath, but she loved the Ozzy book, right? So, you know, you don't have to be totally into Van Halen to love it, but you can be interested in it, and great storytelling, and really what set Van Halen up to be Van Halen. That's what Greg's book's on. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate you, brother.
Anytime.
Greg Randolph joining us here. Wise conversations. We have them around here all the time. It's all brought to you by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. We're letting ourselves play. We're going to be doing the vegan crab cake at the Land of Kush. All of it brought to you by our friends at Goodwill in conjunction with our newest partners at Window Nation. We'll be telling you much, much more about all of that. Rock and roll never dies. Man, I feel like quoting some Van Halen songs right now or quoting Running with the Devil or Hot for Teacher or something like that. But anytime I get a chance to talk a little rock and roll, I like to do that. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking Baltimore positive.